You'll use this one here, sir. Thank you.
Good morning, everybody.
It is.
Indeed. So, I was asked to share my testimony here, and it was kind of an intimidating thing. I had been asked to do that several other times in several other contexts and just said, nope, heck no, that's not a thing I'm going to do. Maybe someday, but not today, not next week. But here I am, and, Eric is really convincing. And I'm sure that other people than me have experienced that as well. So I'm going to lead off with a quote that I'm in the helping professions. I work in the social work field. And kind of like the Kobe Bryant or LeBron of the social work field, her name is Brené Brown. And she's a researcher about connection and authenticity and vulnerability, and has some great books. It's some really good stuff. Everyone has a story that will break your heart. And if you're really paying attention, most people have a story that will bring you to your knees. I'm not sharing that on my behalf. It's that everybody that you encounter on a daily basis has that story. And so just real quick, before I get started here, I just want to give God all the glory, all the praise, and hope that he allows my mess to be a message for his benefit. So my parents met in college at University of Idaho. And after about a year of dating, they decided to drop out of college and start a family. It was, cool, I guess. Things seemed pretty normal when I was younger. But once I started attending school full time, something was definitely off. I was initially raised Catholic, but I recall my parents stopped going to church when I was around 7, when my dad came back from Desert Storm. He was deployed for the better part of a year in that conflict. And I remember asking my father why we didn't go to church anymore, and he said, "God's about as real as the Easter Bunny, son." And that was a real turning point in my young life. It started me down a path of rabid atheism of sorts, and I had a desire to just explain the world around me purely through science, reason. Faith just had no place in my life, and it really had no place in my family. I loathed having to go to church with a few friends that I had, and I remember when setting up sleepovers and play dates that I would want to stay over on a Friday, not on a Saturday, because I didn't want to have to go to church with anybody, any of my friends that had to go, right? In school, I'm not exactly sure what it was, but I was bullied pretty ferociously. I was not just one of, but probably the most unpopular kid in school, in elementary school and junior high. And kids can be mean. They can be really, 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 really mean. And I just couldn't relate to people well at all. My only friends really were books, video games, and later on, at about the age of 12, computers. Back when computers costed like $3,000, my parents managed to get one. Wow, right? I'm sure that some of you remember that time. By this time, my parents were really very unhappy with each other. And my home dynamic was very dysfunctional. They had really become quite abusive with each other and with me. And I, as a result, was abusive back to them. Our home was not a functional place really at all. that they're typically, you know, the consequences, you know, the worst thing that I could have happen would be to make my parents mad, and then they'd start yelling at me, like, oh, we're going to take away Christmas, kid, you know. And there'd be all kinds of things like that, just yelling and consequences. And so what I did is kind of a defense mechanism at that time in my life was I realized I could, whenever one of my parents was mad at me, I could just pit them against the other one. And that was a really effective way of getting the heat off of me, but it really was kind of destructive for the further dynamic that continued in our family life. I really became unwilling to perform at school and have behavioral problems, much like the sorts of kids I work with at Excelsior, because I just didn't have any positive reinforcement in my life. There wasn't really any incentive to do the sorts of things that, you know, were expected of me, so I pretty much didn't do them. And I just shut down because of this lack of positive reinforcement, and it was really devastating as a child. Cast a real dark shadow over my youth and my adulthood. Then as I move on to my life as a teenager, I was raised by my peers, and Fred talked about a lot of the people that he worked with the other day, kind of having that same sort of a thing. And let me tell you, your peers as teenage boys don't have the best ideas about things in life. They really don't. And my parents divorced, and it was not amicable, but a nasty one with a custody lawsuit that spanned years, and I don't even want to know how much money they spent on attorneys. And I just was raised by my peers. I became sexually active early. I spent all my time out with friends, and even though they weren't as bad of a crowd as by many standards, I was smoking cigarettes, marijuana, drinking. And I decided to drop out of high school, that the answers for my life were not contained in high school. And shortly after making that decision, my dad told me that if I wasn't going to go to school or work, I had to move out, so I did. I ended up at what could best be described as a flop house, you know, a whole bunch of guys living together to pitch in on beer and pitch in on rent. There was like 10 of us in this house, and I think that my total monthly expenses all came down to like $90 or $100. I'm old. So that's really where excess drinking became a part of my life. It was in my early teens, in my early 20s, when I, instead of just being a person who drank frequently, I probably met the threshold for what we call an alcoholic. And even though I was an alcoholic high school dropout by this point, the fact that computers were my only friends enabled me to have a successful web design business, and I was making a lot more money than a kid should have, which enabled my addictions more. And I ended up with this girl who got me into a pill addiction and had a kid by another guy, and our dysfunctions and addictions aligned, so it was a great idea to get married, right? Not really. So marriage without God and a biblical principle is not really marriage at all. It's simply signing a piece of paper that says when we inevitably break up, I'm entitled to half your crap and to saddle you with half my debt. That's all it is. If you don't have Jesus in a marriage and you aren't living by those biblical principles, there's not really any point to getting married, and I found that out the fun way. We packed up and moved to Fresno, 1,000 miles away from everyone that we knew and all of our support systems and our family. Wasn't the best decision. I'll spare the nitty-gritty, but our marriage did not work out, and I ended up moving to Los Angeles, where my addiction became worse and worse. I frequently would miss work because I was out drinking and partying. I worked at a prestigious law firm in one of the most expensive parts of Southern California, Calabasas. You guys might be familiar with that, the Kardashian store Dash is there. It's a really, really nice neighborhood, I guess. Houses are, you know, condos are like $2-3 million. Crazy. As an alcoholic, I was still kind of functional, but somehow I had discovered meth the day after Thanksgiving in 2009. And by February in 2010, the methamphetamines had completely taken over my life. I had lost 70 pounds and decided to quit my job. I lost my place to live. My closest friends really wanted nothing to do with me, and I can't blame them. I was completely insane. I was a pariah. I had this feeling of worthlessness and really had no hope. None for a future. I had no hope that things would get better. I was at the very end of a dark path that I had been walking. And I felt like suicide was the only option. And there's this girl that I was dating at the time, and she broke up with me. And I swore that I was going to kill myself, and I told her that. And she got up to leave, and I had this pistol on my nightstand, and I picked it up, and I threw it. I was angry, and she left, and I followed her out. I was like, hey, you know, I was just trying to get her to stay, not be terrified of me. But she left, and I came back inside, and I put the pistol into my mouth, and I pulled the trigger, but it wouldn't fire because the impact when I threw the pistol, it broke the recoil spring, which made it unable to fire. And I was pretty frustrated. I'd put 10,000 rounds through that pistol. I used to, every time I was mad, I would go to the shooting range at lunch, and my life made me mad all day, every day. And if I ever had any doubt in my mind up until that moment that God was real, it was erased. This was that moment where I knew for a fact that God was real. He didn't want me to die, and I was pissed off at him for intervening in that way. I was angry. And I really wish that I could say, you know, that God specifically intervening in my life. You know, now I realize that that was him saying, I have a better plan for you. I have this different thing I want you to do. But I just wanted the pain to end. I just want to escape that constant emotional torment that living as a prodigal had wrought in my life. That day, it was the worst day of my life, and I just lay in bed for a week, just despondent, crying. I wouldn't eat. I wouldn't get up to take a shower. I just was hopeless. And I wish I could say that that was the end of my difficulties, but my addiction became much more rampant as I continued to lose hope. I managed to get another job and got fired. I lost my car and my house and all my possessions, lost my sanity, and worse for me at that time, I lost my ability to procure drugs because I was no longer employed. I first became really homeless in 2011. In my life, I was great at building technology infrastructure and answering emails and resolving issues from users, fixing servers and routers and switches, right? Those skills don't really translate over to living on the streets, to urban camping. It didn't work out at all. I couldn't even do real camping, let alone urban camping of the homeless variety. I was awful at finding food and shelter. I slept outside, and I didn't have any gear or any money or any ability to procure those things. I would sleep at the bus station, in alleys, on park benches, anywhere that I could go and not be bothered until security or police or somebody would tell me to move on my way. What I honestly thought the funniest part about being homeless was is that it is so much easier to find drugs and money than it is to find a shower or a meal or a roof over your head for a single night. And to people who say, oh, they're just doing drugs or whatever, you know, that's just what they want to do. I didn't want to do that anymore. I didn't have any other options. I just was doing what I could to get by and to survive on a daily basis. I didn't come from the streets. I didn't grow up on the streets. I didn't think that committing crimes and stealing from people and hurting people was the way to get by. And so that meant that my economic production, so to speak, when I was doing that was just very minimal. I didn't have a hustle, as they call it. I just would try to hang out and help anybody out that could see any utility in me, because I just wanted to see a shred of value in myself. And if that was through, you know, helping somebody else do whatever they were trying to do, that was what I was doing. And it got me into a lot of troubling situations, but God delivered me from all of those. At this time in my life, especially after that experience I just described, I was completely certain of the existence of God, and I knew Jesus, and I knew that he offered propitiation for all my sins, and that my eternal soul was going to be in heaven, and I knew that. I knew that beyond the shadow of a doubt. I knew that more than I knew the sun was going to come up the next day. I knew that, but I still had many, many more years of struggles. I think partially because what Eric was just saying when I started out here, that when I was like that, I had a very hard time becoming part of a faith community because I socially, economically, and psychologically was such a wreck that nobody wanted to have anything to do with me. I would attend church weekly, but I couldn't find community. I was frequently being arrested and spending days and weeks alone in a jail cell with nothing but the Bible, and I read it. I never doubted God. I merely doubted those he chose to carry on his cause. I felt more judgment and castigation in that faith community than I had in secular communities where my connection was just as broken in my life. As human beings, we are wired for connection. That's why we're here. That's the purpose. What Paul says in 1 Corinthians 12 about feet saying they aren't parts of the body because they aren't hands, well, they're parts of the body. They might not be hands, but their feet or their noses or ears or whatever, we're all woven together. And I was thirsty for the word. I wanted fellowship and communion, but I couldn't have it because I would look like the sort of person that you would cross the street to avoid. One person who never did this was Taylor, lady who's my wife now. She would always take time to check in on me whenever I went to Off-Broadway family outreach, or she'd see me downtown, and she just wanted to make sure I was doing well and cultivated a friendship with me. And even though we came through from wildly different places in life, God's love shining through her is probably why I'm here right now. I was downtown, and I met a man who was a high school teacher through his students that were doing a project down in Riverfront Park. A friend and I were hanging out down there after a long bike ride in the summer of 2014 when some students came up to me for a school project asking about why we didn't believe in God, making assumptions that obviously homeless people are not people of faith. I think this is a pretty neat divine appointment. I had a great conversation with these youth, and they went and found their teacher, and the teacher came and interviewed me and talked with me, and he had a lot of questions about my faith and also felt like it was a divine appointment. I recall talking to him about in Isaiah 58 about the true fasting, the kind of fasting that God wants. And he took down my number. He said he felt convicted by what I had to say. And about a month later, I ended up nearly dying from a traumatic brain injury. I was in the hospital for a week. And then shortly after being released from that hospital, I was in jail again, only this time they decided to send me to Eastern, not the university. This was in July of 2014, and I stayed at Eastern until they discharged me to an inpatient substance use disorder rehab program, which I completed in February of 2015. On the day that I got out, I had a voicemail from this individual who said he had cleared out a room of his apartment, wanted to offer me a place to stay. He insisted I didn't have to pay any rent or look for work. He just wanted me to focus on attending recovery meetings and finding a church home. He said even when his lease was up at the end of the year that we could figure something out. I stayed with him for several months until his landlord found out I was there and kicked me out. This man had already gone through so much more trouble for me, more trouble than my own family had even, so I couldn't bother him any further. I went back to sleeping outside. And this was in the May of 2015. I was completely despondent. I couldn't understand why that I was doing what my therapist said I should do. I was doing what people in the faith community said I should do. I wasn't doing drugs. I was just trying so hard to do the right thing. And I was connected to the recovery community, and I still face these hardships. I had nothing but a backpack and a bike again, but I was determined not to end up the way that I was before. I had a friend who woke me up and asked me if I wanted to ride my bike with him to Seattle. And I said, sure. So 7 days later, we were in Seattle. I'm pretty sure I could do it in 2 or 3 days now. After that, I went to Olympia, Portland, Salem, Corvallis, Eugene, and I ended up all the way in California. My goal was to make it down to San Diego and then perhaps ride to the Atlantic Ocean, kind of like Forrest Gump, just keep riding. I didn't know what I wanted to do, but I knew that I was on a pilgrimage of sorts. I was trying to find where I belonged. I found out in Northern California, the fun way, that I still had a misdemeanor warrant for a drunk in public down in Los Angeles County when I used to live there. And in Washington, they won't take you like from Spokane County to Stevens County on a misdemeanor warrant, but in California, they'll send you all the way down there. And I ended up in Los Angeles. So in Los Angeles County Jail, Twin Towers, the largest on-site jail facility in the world. Interesting place. They only had me in there for a couple weeks because it was just a misdemeanor. The jail was full, you know, and then I was out and I was in downtown Los Angeles on Skid Row, and I didn't have any of my gear. I didn't have a bicycle. I didn't have anything. All that stuff stayed where I was arrested at, 1,000 miles away. And so I didn't know what to do. I was back to being homeless, and I had a stolen, broken-down bicycle, and I was panhandling for 40s. For those of you who don't know, malt liquor comes in a 40-ounce container. It's really nasty. They're about $2, $3, and you know, if you can get one down, I'd be impressed. So I ended up passing out behind a church. I didn't even know what day it was. And the pastor woke me up in the morning. He had a cup of coffee and a plate of pastries. He invited me into the church. He's like, we'd be really honored if you'd come join us for church today, right? And this was a really affluent, upscale neighborhood. This was in Santa Clarita, Newhall. So it was a really... You couldn't afford to live there unless you're making $250,000 a year or so. And so it was obviously a pretty, you know, I was pretty incongruent with the rest of this church population. I was very obviously, I like to call it hobo fried. I had that beard out to here. I hadn't showered in weeks. And everybody, I mean, they obviously were kind of like, you know, whispering and talking and coming up and giving me hugs and doing their Christian duty and everything. And it was nice. It was cool. It was also in October, so there was a harvest festival. All the kids are running around their little costumes, and they had a chili cook-off and a brownie baking competition. I got to eat all the chili and brownies I could eat, and I was like, man, my life's never going to be like these people. I'm never going to go to a church chili cook-off. What are you talking about, right? And everybody was leaving, and there was an older gentleman. He had to have been in his 70s. It's pretty old. And he came up to me. He gave me $20, and he's just like, you know what, man? Do something good for yourself here, like buy yourself a nice dinner, go get a truck stop shower, go to the 24-hour laundromat and do your laundry. Just don't get loaded. Like, I'm giving you this. God's telling me to give you this. So you just do something that makes your life a little bit better today, because you know that that doesn't make your life better. And that was the moment right there. That was the moment right there where I realized I could not do that. And I went down to the corner store and I bought 240s and a pack of cigarettes. And I passed out drunk in front of the AA meeting hall. And I went to every single meeting that next day, every meeting the day after that, and every meeting the day after that. And after about a week of being the hobo who was stinking up the AA meeting hall, somebody was like, we gotta get this guy out of here, right? But we can't get him out of here when he's doing what he's supposed to be doing, so let's call somebody to give him a job so at least he'll take a shower. So that's what happened. There was this guy, his name was Tom Brown, and he had been in the Santa Clarita AA for a while, and he had this house he was working on. I called him, and he's like, do you know how to do construction at all? No. Can you swing a hammer? Not without hitting my hand. Do you know how to do anything? I'm like, do you need a website? Do you need your computer fixed? Like, I know how to do that. And he's like, okay, cool. Well, you start tomorrow. And evidently, I did well enough that I kept doing that. I kept doing it the next day. And I ended up just continuing to work on this house with Tom Brown. He let me stay there. And I learned a little bit about construction, not enough to be handy around my own house. But I kept on going to meetings, and I stayed sober, and I made the decision. I was going to this church, and they had this whole thing like, oh, let's we're doing baptisms. You wanna do a water baptism? And I was like, heck yeah. And then I got baptized, and I was living in the Word, and I was going to recovery meetings, and everything just kind of clicked in my life. I just kept on keeping on, and different opportunities opened themselves to me. It was in February of 2016 that Taylor wanted me to come back to Spokane, and she helped facilitate that. I was staying with my father, and I still was not really well put together when I stepped into the rooms here at Jacob's Well. I was looking for a church. I wasn't really having, you know, luck. I'd gone to several different places, and it didn't just quite feel right. And I'd been having really fun interactions with Eric on Facebook for a year or two at that time, I think, because he was writing for the Spokane Faith and Values thing. And I would always kind of poke fun at him. I'd call him Metal Beard because he looked like he's in a death metal band. That long, you know, metal beard. And I listened to his sermons on the website, and I heard about broken things being repaired and purpose driven from pain. And when I showed up, even being kind of in grungy clothes and not quite there yet with my girlfriend because we weren't married, you know, I wasn't all there yet, but people made sure here at Jacob's Well that I felt welcomed, that I was accepted, that I was a part of, and I hadn't felt that in a really long time. And so I remember that people being kind and encouraging us to come back and genuinely having an interest in our lives and coming up and talking to us, and that was what got us here. And I remember Taylor having tears of joy listening to the worship the very first time that we were here too. And it's just, it's the place for us. And I also feel like it was the prayer warriors at this church that helped me become the sort of person who could work in the helping profession. I think they prayed me into my career at Excelsior here. And God has just continued to grant favor for myself and my family, being here with the examples that people have in this church. And the transformation, it's not even been 3 full years. And I can't claim any credit. Honestly, I still got more issues than the Times, and they've been a newspaper since the late 18th century. I'm tore up from the floor up, beat up from the feet up. Need a checkup from the neck up. But despite all that, God has granted me the desires of my heart and given me a purpose, and that's to be a part of this church body, to raise my child and lead my wife, a career in social services, helping out youth that had upbringings like mine, or worse, choose a different path, and to spread the good news of Jesus and the amazing things he has done in my life to anybody who will listen. I was bad off. I was so bad. That prodigal living described in Luke 15 was not even close to how far I had descended into a life of sin, drugs, madness. I was completely hopeless, and everybody, especially myself, had given up on me years ago. God does not make junk. He doesn't give up, and he doesn't quit. It wasn't just enough for me to believe his word. That was the easy part. That was the proof. I believed it more than I believed in gravity or that the sun would rise tomorrow. The compelling thing about God, far more compelling than the word and the truth, is his love. His love is so overpowering, so overwhelming, relentless, and unstoppable. And for me, his love had to be demonstrated through others enough to make me begin to love myself again. It was you all and people in the rooms of AA and other people in my life who did that. And I believe that church is to be a hospital for the sick, the broken, and the hopeless. And we have to be here to allow God's love to shine through us, which he enables with the gifting of his spirit within us. All we have to do is ask for that power and obey. And I don't know if I'd be able to do the sorts of things today that many people did for me when I was in that situation. That's probably the hardest thing for me to process through right now, is I'm not in a position where I could just give a random homeless person a room in my house. I'm not in the position where I could give somebody a job and have them, you know, work on a house and, you know, let them, you know, do those sorts of things. But I hope that I will be in a place someday soon where I could do that. And I realize that God does not just call the qualified, he qualifies the called. And as long as we listen to that call, he'll qualify us, and he's faithful. He'll grant us the anointing to enable his purposes, and I pray that all of you have this anointing over your lives, and that the horrible mess my life used to be can continue to be used as a message to demonstrate God's grace, glory, and relentless love. Thanks.